Look at that. Gavin dashed over to the couch and picked it up. The 2-foot-wide, 1-foot-tall, 6-inch-deep display case was glassed in, but the glass was cracked. Inside of the case was an object that looked to Jack like an old computer keyboard. It was thick and beige with brown keys. Jack didn't get it. Why is Gavin so fired up? What's the big deal?
Are you kidding? That's an old Commodore 64. I had one of those when I was a kid. How freaking awesome is that?
Jack shrugged. Couldn't say. He pointed at a cut-up padded chair tossed on its side. What's that? Gavin looked at Jack like he was the village idiot.
That's a reclining racing simulator cockpit driving seat with a gear shift, steering wheel, and pedal mounts. Dude must have been a serious racer.
As in computer games. Gavin's eyes said, duh, even if his mouth didn't. Gavin set the broken display case back down on the couch gently, as if it were a rare Egyptian artifact, then pointed at the 85-inch LG TV on the wall.
Runza sure had an awesome setup.
Gavin walked over to the shelving beneath the TV. He pointed at the rectangular dust outline on the top shelf.
They took his game machine.
Gavin bent close to the dust outline.
Judging by the size of the imprint, I'd say this was an Xbox One X.
He glanced around the room and pointed to a broken controller lying in the corner.
Yep, definitely a One X.
Why?
Game consoles are serious machines, especially this one. It has a 1 terabyte hard drive, 12 gigabytes of RAM, and a whopping 6 teraflop GPU. If I was hiding files, that's where I'd put them.
Jack kicked aside one of the dozens of emptied game polyboxes. Most of the titles were racing games, especially cars. Took the DVDs, too.
Yeah, an even better place to stash stuff.
Jack swore. Whatever Runso might have stored anywhere in the house had probably been found and taken away, either by the FBI or, more likely, Samler.
Hey!
Gavin's high-pitched shriek spun Jack around on his heels. He reached beneath his sport coat. By the time he faced Gavin, the Glock 43 was in both of Jack's steady hands at low ready. Gavin's eyes went wide as dinner plates.
Wow, that was a Wyatt Earp fast draw if I ever saw one.
A scream will do that. Jack holstered his weapon, half angry but mostly relieved. What did you see? Gavin bent over and picked up a cracked photo frame and handed it to Jack. It was a photo of Elon Musk with his signature, addressed to Runso.
How cool is that?
Jack frowned, unimpressed. Until he had a thought. He glanced around the room again and handed Gavin the photo frame back. What do you make of that?
He must have met Elon. That would be awesome.
Jack shook his head. Look around you. What do you see? Gavin did as he was told. His face lit up with a smile. He held up the photo.
You're right, Jack. Runso was into cars.
I bet he even owns a Tesla.
Let's go. Jack led the way back out through the kitchen, stopping briefly at the door to make sure no one was watching them. Then he and Gavin dashed over to the garage and pulled open the door. No car. The garage was completely empty, just a couple of rakes and a shovel hanging on nails on the walls. Gavin tugged at the messenger bag that kept slipping off his shoulder. Jack pointed at the floor. Looks like there were storage boxes in here, a lot of them. Whoever took them thought there was something in them. Something that had to be gone through with a fine-tooth comb. My guess is tax records, business records, that sort of thing. They took them because otherwise they'd be standing in here for hours going through them.
Makes sense, Jack.
But where's his car? The only thing I can think of is at the airport where he left it before his trip to Spain.
No, I mean, if he's a car guy and he has a garage but he uses it for file storage, where does he keep his car?
That's a great question.
I have an idea.
We're looking for a key fob, Gavin said, stepping over pots and pans on the kitchen floor, his head on a swivel. Tesla has a phone app that will open your car and start it at a distance, but they also make fobs. Find the fob, we find the car.
How do we find the car with the fob?
You find the fob, I'll find the car.
Gavin went over to a key rack screwed into the wall. A couple of lock keys were on it, and probably a spare house key.
I didn't see a fob when we went through before, Jack said.
Me neither.
But I think I can find it.
Gavin reached into his messenger bag and pulled out a handheld electronic device.
Fobs put out a constant RF signal that communicates with its paired vehicle. In North America, that signal broadcasts at 315 megahertz, plus or minus 2.5 megahertz, depending on the make and model.
He held up the device. And this, my friend, is an RF signal detector, tuned to the same wavelength range.
Seriously, you just happen to carry one of those around?
Gavin patted his messenger bag.
I have all kinds of goodies in here. Like I told you before, you're the physical, I'm the technical.
Just cross your fingers that Runso wasn't paranoid and parked his fob in a Faraday bag.
Gavin switched on his device.
If Runso was just a little paranoid, he'd know not to keep it near a door where thieves can stand outside and capture the signal, amplify it, and send it to another thief standing by the car with the transmitter imitating his fob.
Yeah, everybody knows that.
Yeah. Everybody in this house not named Jack. Come on.
Gavin found the fob signal and within 5 minutes found the fob, tucked inside a toilet paper roll lying on the bathroom floor.
Okay. So he was a little paranoid. But there you go.
Gavin pulled it out and handed it to Jack.
What good is this if we don't know where the car is? Don't you have to be, like, 3 feet away for this to work?
Jack hit the button.
Nothing.
You need to be 3 feet away.
I don't.
Gavin walked over to a street-facing window and pulled back the curtain. He then pulled out another device and held it up.
Note, one aforementioned amplifier.
He turned it on.
Hit the button again.
Jack did.
They both saw it.
A pair of headlights flashed dimly beneath a plain car cover just 200 feet up the street.
You didn't hear the engine start, because it's electric, Gavin said in a professorial tone.
Thanks, Elon. I might have worked that one out for myself.
We need to check out the car.
It might have just the clue we've been looking for.
Still confident they weren't being watched by killer mercenaries, FBI agents, or even curious neighbors, Jack and Gavin lifted the car cover, folded it up, and tossed it into the back seat of the sporty Tesla Midnight Silver Model S.
Jack handed Gavin the keys to the Jeep.
Meet me at the funeral home we passed earlier. We can't leave it here.
Gotcha.
Jack climbed into the Tesla and drove the short distance back to the Barry funeral home parking lot.
He pulled the Model S into a spot toward the back where they could work undisturbed and camouflaged by other parked cars.
Gavin parked next to him and climbed into the passenger seat next to Jack with his messenger bag in tow.
It only took them a few minutes to pull up the Tesla's onboard map. From there, Gavin hacked into the car's hard drive and downloaded all of its GPS records onto his tablet.
The GPS data only went back 8 months, which was when Runso had apparently purchased the vehicle.
With the Tesla data on his tablet, Gavin pulled up a map of the area and downloaded the GPS coordinates onto it, generating thousands of blue lines traversing roads all over Knoxville and the areas surrounding it. Two giant nodes stood out far and above all of the others. Runso's home, and one other location.
What's this place? Jack asked.
Gavin pulled it up on Google Maps.
No name.
Looks like some kind of an industrial park or a distribution facility.
Gavin dropped the little yellow street-level man on the location. The pictures that came up were blurred.
Wow.
Didn't expect that, Gavin said.
That's either a top-secret government facility, or somebody paid big bucks to do that.
I think it's time we paid a visit to Runso's real office.
Chapter 64.
Jack and Gavin took the Wrangler for the 16-minute trek toward the travel node they identified as Runso's primary workplace. They left Runso's Tesla parked at the funeral home, but took the fob with them in case somebody else finally figured out what Gavin had already put together. Jack reminded Gavin to play it cool on the drive-by. No finger-pointing, or phone cameras, or even long stares at the place were allowed. He didn't want to draw any attention from their security people as the two of them made their surveillance run. They drove past the main gate. The property was protected by a 15-foot-high chain-link fence topped with razor wire. Tall lampposts were planted like trees everywhere, and lights were fixed to the warehouse walls. The place lit up like a Christmas tree at night, Jack assumed. Security cameras were everywhere. A simple white sign facing the road displayed three letters, WML, along with the street address. A uniformed guard stepped out of his booth and approached an 18-wheeler that had just pulled up. It wasn't hard to see the pistol on the guard's hip, even from the road. Several other freight trucks were backed into loading bays. Civilian workers loaded and unloaded the trailers with forklifts and dollies. Jack spotted at least one security man on the loading dock as well, wearing civilian clothes. But his short cropped hair, physical build, and determined gait gave him away. It looked like the main offices for the facility were located at this first building. White decal letters with the name WML were stuck on the glass doors leading inside. Jack drove on farther down the road past a second gate and more security guards. Freshly painted military combat and support vehicles were parked in rows in the expansive yard. A freight train rumbled slowly past behind the property inside the fence. From where he sat on the road, it seemed to Jack that the railroad track was elevated, along with the rest of the property, above the wide and greenish river. Power lines paralleled the train track as well. Jack kept driving, following Gavin's tracking program. It beeped when they passed a third gate, indicating that this was the place where Runzo had driven to so many times in his Tesla. A tanker truck hauling liquid nitrogen was parked just outside the closed gate. The driver was showing ID to an armed uniformed guard, while another security man in civilian clothes climbed up into the cab. A second uniformed guard examined the undercarriage of the truck with an inspection mirror. A dozen refrigerated trucks were unloading. Several were branded with familiar food company names. Jack saw forklifts driven by men wearing insulated coveralls inside the open rolling doors. The same freight train rolling past the other building was now approaching this one, its brakes and steel wheels screeching to a coupler clanging stop. Jack kept driving. He knew that security cameras pointed at the road captured every vehicle entering and exiting the gate of this more secure facility, and almost certainly every vehicle driving on the frontage road. He put another mile between him and the distribution facility before pulling into a vacant lot on the side of the road. What did you see, Gav?
Pretty big place. Three entrances. Armed guards, which I guess isn't that big of a deal for a place storing lots of stuff.
Did you notice the undercover guards? Not your typical rent-a-cops.
Not really. My peripheral vision kinda sucks.
Some of those guys were strapped. Real operator types.
That second facility had military vehicles parked there, Gavin said. Maybe that's why.
What about the refrigerated facility? Why do you need armed guards there? And they seemed to be the most paranoid.
They must be guarding something really valuable.
I'm guessing it's not the trailers full of Stouffer's Meat Lover's Lasagna. My personal favorite, by the way. So tell me about Runzo. Why would a brainiac like him work in a frozen food warehouse? The transition from ORNL to here doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Unless they're working on a top-secret frozen pizza recipe inside of that place. I don't think they'd need the kinds of clearances he had.
And he wouldn't need a physics degree to work in there. So what would he have been doing at ORNL?
It was redacted from the records, but he was working on a project even your dad would have a hard time accessing. It had to be something on the bleeding edge of national defense. Next-gen nukes? Directed energy weapons? Electromagnetic railguns? Something like that. At ORNL, sure. But at a frozen food warehouse?
Gavin scratched his flaky scalp.
I know. It doesn't make sense. We need to get in there, but the security was too tight back there to try and fake our way in. And there's only two of us, so it's not like we're going to fight our way in.
Fight our way in?
Jack fought back a smile. Good call.
I think we should call the FBI or DOD and have this place checked out.
And what would we tell them? There's a warehouse full of Swanson TV dinners that pose a threat to national security you need to investigate? Yeah, I guess it does sound kind of stupid. Gavin's stomach gurgled like a jar of fermenting kimchi. I'm getting kind of hungry. How about we go hit up Calhoun's? I think it's only like 15 minutes from here.
Sure, why not? Give us a chance to regroup and plan our next move.
Jack put the Jeep in gear and checked for traffic in his rearview mirror. A big refrigerated truck rumbled past, throwing brightly colored leaves, heading back toward Knoxville. As soon as it cleared, Jack pulled back onto the two-lane and followed him, his mind working on the problem at hand while Gavin scrolled through Calhoun's online menu. They rolled along at the posted 30-mile-an-hour speed limit for a few miles. Suddenly, Gavin shouted,
"I'm such an idiot! How can I have been so stupid?"
He thumped his forehead with the palm of his hand.
"Whoa, Gav, take it easy. It's just lunch.
We need to get back to Runzo's."
"Why?"
"Now, Jack. We need to get back now."
Chapter 65
Jack pulled into the back of Runzo's house again, keeping the Wrangler out of sight from the street. Jack and Gavin each pulled another pair of gloves on, then made their way back into the house and into the gaming room. Gavin led the way.
"Geez, Gav, what's got your tail knotted up?"
Gavin ran over to the broken shadow box with the Commodore 64 and picked it up. He stared longingly at it through the cracked glass, like he was reuniting with a lost love.
"Do you have a knife, Jack?"
Jack pulled out his EDC blade, the same Kershaw blur he'd plunged into Van Delden's thigh back at the steel mill. He snicked the razor-sharp steel open and handed the knife to Gavin, handle first. Gavin turned the shadow box over and set it face down on the carpet. He took the knife and carefully cut away the backing, revealing the power plug and connecting cords and cables. There was another, thicker backing that supported the computer on the other side. There were also three small packages wrapped in plain brown paper.
"Oh, baby."
Gavin opened the first wrapped package carefully, as if he were handling an original version of the Constitution. Gavin sighed with deep satisfaction, even reverence.
"And it has the cartridges, too."
"And that's a good thing?" Gavin then wedged the tip of the blade beneath the thin, twisted wire ties that held the computer in place against the thick backing.
"Is this really the time to play a game of Pong?" Jack asked, watching Gavin proceed with surgical precision.
"Runzo's a genius."
"I know, because I'm one too," Gavin said. "And every young genius that could get his or her hands on one of these babies did so, or drove their parents crazy trying."
A minute later, Gavin had the Commodore 64 removed. He picked it up, along with its accessory parts and the cartridges, and carried it over to the big screen TV that was attached to a wall mount. He set the sacred objects down like a priest placing a sacrifice on the altar. He pulled the TV away and exposed its back and connecting ports.
"Runzo thought of everything,"
Gavin whispered. He turned to Jack. "He was one of the good guys. I just know it."
"Because he played old video games."
"Just watch."
Gavin hooked up the Commodore 64 and powered it up.
"Come to Papa,"
Gavin whispered as the machine's startup screen displayed on the TV. Commodore Basic V2, 64K RAM system, 38,911 basic bytes free. Ready.
"Now watch this."
Gavin inserted one of the gaming cartridges into the slot on the side of the unit. The TV display pulled up another screen. "Password?"
"Aha! I knew it!"
"What?"
"You don't password games, Jack. Not back then. He's hiding something."
"Can you hack this thing?"
"I'm hurt, Jack. I really am.
Runzo's a gamer, just like me.
And a gamer's got a game.
So I know how this dude thinks."
Gavin's chubby fingers began dancing on the keyboard. "You keep on that. I'm heading back to Runzo's job site. Call me if you find anything."
"Will do."
Gavin glanced up at Jack, worried.
"Careful, okay?"
"You keep your ears open, too. No telling who might be coming back."
Jack pulled his Glock and held it out, but first.
"You might need this."
Gavin glanced at the pistol and shook his head.
"I think you might need it more." After studying the map, Jack made a turn onto a side road 5 minutes away from the distribution center, a plan forming in his mind. His phone rang. It was Gavin.
How'd it go?
I got in.
Fantastic. You really are a genius.
It's far worse than we thought, Jack. Dear God.
Gavin's voice cracked with emotion.
Worse?
What? How?
Runso was working on a project called Tribulation.
Tribulation? We're looking for Rapture.
Tribulation is Rapture, but not exactly. They're both quantum computer projects, universal QPUs, entangled particles, the whole nine yards. Only Rapture is the ORNL project, and Tribulation is a parallel project. Stolen, basically, by Runso and a lady named Parsons.
Is a true quantum computer even possible?
It must be, since they did it.
That's not good. A quantum computer that powerful changes everything.
Jack knew something about them from his time in Singapore when he busted a Chinese attempt to steal quantum software technology. But the stuff they were doing back then was nowhere near this powerful.
Yeah,
it does change everything, Gavin said. And in the wrong hands, it changes everything for the worse. There isn't a computer in the world today that can withstand a quantum brute force attack.
What else?
It gets worse.
Gavin filled in the details.
Gavin was right. It was far worse than they could ever have imagined.
Chapter 66, Washington, D.C., Oval Office, the White House. President Ryan was sitting at the Resolute desk when his private cell phone rang. The people who had access to that number were a privileged few, including his wife and kids. They knew to only use it for an extreme emergency, because they knew he'd answer it no matter what, even if the world was on fire. It was Jack Jr.
Son, what's wrong?
He could barely hear Jack for the interference.
I don't have time to explain, but Gavin and I just found out that there's going to be a $5 trillion robbery any time now. It's an operation using a quantum computer called Tribulation, and there's more.
Ryan was stunned. How did Jack find this out?
You're too late. It's already happened.
What?
Son, I'm putting you on speakerphone. I'm here with Secretary of the Treasury Stephen Hodges and the Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Wesley Moorcroft. Tell them what else you know about Tribulation. We still need more information about which banks were hit.
The banks? Forget the banks. Gavin can fill you in on that later. Right now, we've got a real DEFCON situation about to hit us.
What do you mean?
Tribulation's next target is a joint Chinese-Russian military exercise in the Bering Sea called Snowdragon. They're going to use Tribulation to hack their systems. These assholes want to start World War III.
When?
Now!
The color drained from Ryan's face.
So we're too late?
Not necessarily. The intel said the launch date was today.
I'm assuming it's happening now. Or maybe we still have a little time. All I know is that we've got to shut it down now, no matter what.
How?
Tribulation is in Knoxville. That's where I am, too.
There's an FBI SWAT team in Knoxville, Ryan said. What's the address for this Tribulation thing?
He grabbed a pad and pen from his desk and wrote the address down as Jack recited it. He ripped the paper from the pad and shoved it into Arnie's hands.
Call Director Medina. Tell her to get her SWAT team to this address ASAP. Fill her in on what you've heard and have her call me for anything else she needs. And get Scott, Bob, and Mary Pat up here pronto.
On it, boss.
Arnie bolted into action.
One more thing, Pop, Jack said over the speakerphone. Get an FBI team down to Houston.
Ryan shouted at Arnie halfway out the door.
Arnie, hold up!
He turned back to the phone.
Why Houston?
Because Buck Logan is the asshole behind all of this.
Logan?
Gavin can fill you in, but you better grab Logan before he hears about Knoxville.
You catch that? Ryan asked Van Damme.
I'll put the call into Medina right now.
Son, any chance you can get over to that address? Be our eyes on the ground. It'll be at least 30 minutes before the FBI can saddle up.
Get there. I'm already here.
Sit tight, then. I'll get back to you when I know more.
You did good, son.
Son?
Jack's line was dead. Chapter 67. Sulu Sea, off the coast of Mindanao, the Philippines. Guzman leaned on the starboard rail of the Lupita, admiring the luminous full moon shimmering in the boundless dark of the infinite sea. He smoked his cigar, contemplating his next move. Tribulation had launched according to the encoded text from El Jefe, though the meaning and purpose of it had never been fully explained to him. The same text also confirmed that another payment had been deposited into the Samler account. Sablek's widow would get her husband's share, and his as well. Money meant nothing to Guzman. Loyalty was everything. His people would end this mission with enough cash to walk away if they wanted to. Many of them would. He could not. He'd thought long and hard about Van Tilden's death, as well as Sablek's and Biekov's, now confirmed. Death was not such a bad thing, he'd decided. It was the negation of suffering, and the end of fear. Unless, of course, there was a hell. Then suffering and fear would only be the beginning. But he'd given up on the concept of such things long ago. This life was hell enough. He felt strangely content. The mission he'd been hired to do had been accomplished. The next 2 weeks were secondary. He'd complete those as well. And then, the next job. He blew a cloud of smoke into the cool night air and tossed the butt into the water near the hull. It bounced against the oily gray hide of a tiger shark. Halfway across the world, a digital monitor displayed 4 red icons in oceans around the globe. They represented 4 Samler motherships. A 5th, located in the Sulu Sea, the Lupita, was still yellow. It turned red in that instant. The technician smiled. She had remotely activated the automatic return homing devices in the Tiger Shark drones. She had also deactivated the mothership's drone tracking devices and ignored requests for technical assistance. The nearest drone sharks returned undetected to their respective motherships and, on command, detonated as instructed. Guzman's was the last. The remaining sharks also self-detonated, destroying all evidence of their existence. Everything had gone exactly according to plan. All of the loose ends were tied off. She sent an encrypted text to her employer. Guzman dead. Project terminated. She shut down her computer, smirking with satisfaction at a job well done. She would receive one heck of a bonus for this. She stretched and yawned, but the sound of automatic gunfire outside shut her pretty little mouth. She leaped to her feet and grabbed her backpack with her wallet, passport, car keys, and a Ruger 327 LCR. There was a hidden emergency exit in the back of her office that led to the underground garage. As she turned to run, her office door blasted open, nearly tearing the hinges off. An FBI agent in tactical gear and bump helmet stood in the doorway, flecks of blood on his face. She dropped her backpack. The SWAT leader pointed his M4 carbine at her chest. Where the hell is Logan? Chapter 68. Knoxville, Tennessee. After studying the map earlier, Jack located a service road with an underpass beneath the elevated embankment that took him near the river. As soon as he exited the underpass, he turned off the service road and onto the narrow dirt track that ran between the river and the embankment. The big knobby tires on the Wrangler splashed dark mud and bright leaves as it raced toward the distribution center. He was hidden from view the entire way, including when he passed the razor wire demarcating the massive WML distribution complex. He slammed his brakes and skidded to a halt. He was opposite the engine of the train he'd heard pulling to a stop at the frozen food warehouse earlier when he and Gavin did their drive-by. The Wrangler was still below the elevated railroad embankment and hidden from sight on the other side. Jack jumped out and disengaged the release lever on the winch and unspooled the high-capacity rope. He pulled on the steel winch hook and coiled the rope around his shoulder as he went. After he unspooled the entire 80-foot length, he freed the other end attached to the winch drum by cutting the small-diameter Dyneema loop spliced to the end of the rope with his knife. With 80 feet of 12,000-pound capacity rope secured across his chest like a bandolier, he scrambled up the embankment. He dropped to his stomach near the fence, peering beneath the train's big steel wheels, checking for guards or workers who might be in the area. The last several cars of the long train were being unloaded with forklifts and work gangs, too far away to be of any concern. At least for now. So far, so good. Now for the fun part. Razor wire. Jack pulled off the rope coil and set it on the ground, took off his sport coat and picked up the rope coil again. Slipping his index finger through the hanging loop in the back of his coat, he grabbed the fence and started his climb. The big diesel train engine shielded him from any eyes that might be watching for him on the other side. When he reached the razor wire on top, he threw his sport coat over it and climbed over, then worked his way down the other side, dropping to the ground for the last few feet. He dropped to his stomach again and did another scan. Everybody seemed to be going about their business around the yard. Nobody was in close proximity to Jack. If something as catastrophic as tribulation was going on inside the frozen warehouse, these people outside were obviously unaware of it. Jack scuttled toward the front of the engine, opposite of his target, the building just on the other side of the train that stood next to the warehouse itself. The HVAC building. Jack put together a stupidly simple plan. Emphasis on stupid, he whispered to himself, kneeling down by one of the train's big steel wheels. He didn't have any other options. Shutting tribulation down immediately was the objective, and he knew the FBI was still 20 minutes out. He couldn't risk waiting for them. Hell might be breaking loose even now. Without the other campus gunfighters to assist, without blueprints and schematics of the facility, and outnumbered by at least 10 armed security men, all operators by the look of them, he could only come up with one wild-ass long-shot Hail Mary solution. Gavin's brief to him on the phone about tribulation included one interesting fact. The computer they built relied on super low temperatures. Almost absolute zero, Gavin had said. The only thing Jack could think of was the HVAC unit he'd spotted from his drive-by. He thought about taking out the power lines that ran along the track, but a computer with that kind of sensitivity would have some kind of power backup like a generator. There was no way to kill the power to any of the facility for any length of time. That left one option. Jack crawled beneath the engine in the space between the giant diesel tanks, the rope still looped around his shoulder. Luckily, the rail car immediately behind the engine had already been freighted. All of the loading activity was still taking place far in the back, far away from him. Everyone associated with the train was focused there. It was go time. Now or never. Jack scanned the area one last time, then dashed out from beneath the train and sped over to the cinderblock HVAC building. He dropped down low behind it, once again finding cover from eyes and cameras that might be searching the area. Or so he hoped. He turned the corner and tried the steel doorknob into the building. That would be the easy way in. But it was locked. He swore and returned to the back wall again. He then slipped a quick peek at the wall opposite the door. Bingo. A service ladder was bolted on the outside of the building, leading to the roof. Jack dashed over to it and scrambled up like a monkey on crack. He reached the top and dropped to his belly again. The big refrigeration unit's massive compressor roared inside its aluminum housing. Hot exhaust blew through the long metal louvers. And the electric motor that ran the whole thing hummed furiously next to Jack. Thank you, baby Jesus. Jack pulled the rope off his shoulder and unwound it enough to be able to grab the steel winch hook. He secured it through the massive eye bolt welded to the top of the motor casing used to pick up the heavy device for installation and removal. Jack scanned the yard again. He was still undetected. He pulled the remainder of coiled rope back over his shoulder and let it out as he climbed down the ladder, retracing his steps to the train. He quickly knotted the other end around a steel I-beam of the engine's undercarriage, and then stopped himself. The rope was rated for 12,000 pounds of weight. The electric HVAC motor weighed 1,000 pounds at most. But the motor was bolted to the rooftop of the building. Was the rope strong enough to bust those bolts? Maybe not. Shit. He made a quick calculation. It should work. Jack untied the rope and, instead of securing it, looped the end of it around the same undercarriage steel I-beam, then pulled the end of the rope and brought the rest of the rope through it. He double-checked to make sure he was clear, then dashed back up the ladder. He ran the end of the rope through the eye-bolt a second time. He scrambled back down the ladder to tie the end off again beneath the engine, and slammed into a security guard. The guard's hand flew to his sidearm as he shouted, "What the fu-" But Jack was faster, and a throat punch cut the man off mid-sentence. Gasping for air and grabbing his broken larynx, the man crumpled to his knees. Jack smashed his own big knee into the man's lower jaw, flopping him back into the dirt, knocked out cold. Jack snatched the man's pistol out of its Kydex holster and shoved it into his own waistband, then scurried back under the train and finished tying off the rope. It might have been a really dumb idea, but at least now he had 24,000 pounds of pull to work with, instead of just 12. Jack scrambled back to the fallen guard. He grabbed the stocky man by the shoulders and dragged him back underneath the train, then pushed him down the embankment. Jack couldn't tell if he was still breathing. Any other day, he might have stopped to try and help him, but right now one man's life wasn't worth the millions at risk, especially a Samler puke. If that's what he was. Only one thing left to do. The train engineer slept like a log in his seat, his watch alarm not due to go off for another 20 minutes. But the shock of cold steel pressing into his ear woke him early. His groggy eyes widened at the sight of Jack's Glock pointed at his gray-bearded face. "What's this?" Jack pointed around the engineer's side of the cabin. "This is a train, and you're an engineer. Let's get this thing moving." The man sat up. "Moving? Where? I can't..." Jack pressed the pistol against his forehead. "Now, move this rig."
"Where?"
"About 100 feet should do it." "Look, mister," Jack pointed at the control panel with his pistol. "That's the brake release, that's the throttle, and that's the dead man's handle. Either you can run this thing, or I can blow your brains out and run it for you. Decide which it's going to be before I finish squeezing this trigger."
"Okay, okay."
The 4,000-horsepower General Electric EMD 710 series V16 diesel motor roared into life as the throttle engaged to the first position. Couplers banged as the wheels began moving. Loaders way back down the line started cursing and shouting, wondering what the hell was going on. The train inched forward, pulling 45 cars and flatbeds along with it, creating chaos with the guys still inside or on the forklifts. The double-tied rope that Jack had fixed to the undercarriage strained as the train lurched ahead. 10 feet later, the rope was taut as a violin string. The train kept moving. The big eye-bolt on top of the electric motor began to bend, threatening to shear off as the motor mount bolts held fast to the concrete platform. But the cheap Chinese iron bolts that held the motor to the platform gave way first, snapping like twigs. The electric motor tipped over. The drive belt running from the motor to the HVAC unit inside slipped off its drive wheel. The train rolled on. 30 seconds later, the big electric motor crashed to the dirt, dragging down its thick power line along with the transformer it was connected to. Jack had killed the HVAC compressor. No more deep freeze. Klaxons blared. Jack had definitely kicked the hornet's nest with this one. He turned around just as a pair of heavy boots clanged onto the steel deck of the cabin behind him. The uniformed guard was breathing heavily from his sprint to catch the slow-moving train and the scramble up its 8-foot ladder to engineering. He saw Jack's pistol in his hand and reached for his own. A 147-grain 9mm bullet from Jack's Glock 43 plowed into the man's forehead. Brain tissue and bone fragments splattered the fire extinguisher on the wall behind him. The guard dropped to the floor. Bullets suddenly spanged inside the train cab, fired from outside through the window facing the warehouse. A few bullets ricocheted inside, like hornets. The engineer screamed and grabbed his wounded arm. "Let's get out of here," Jack said, grabbing the man by the shoulder. "We're done here." Jack dragged the engineer out of his seat, When the engineer's hand left the dead man's handle, the train's brakes engaged, steel wheels screeched. Jack and the engineer stumbled as Jack hauled him by the shoulders toward the door. Another guard was climbing up the ladder. Jack kicked him just beneath his nose with the toe of his boot. Even through the heavy leather, Jack could feel the crunch of snapping bone and cartilage. The man flew backward, hitting the ground like a rag doll, his unconscious mind unable to brace his body for the fall. Jack dragged the engineer forward, but the older man jerked away, still clutching his wounded arm.
"Shoot me here or leave me alone.
I can help you."
"Go to hell! You've helped enough. I can take care of myself."
"Suit yourself. Thanks for the ride, old-timer."
"Shove it, asshole!"
Jack slid down the ladder, stopping himself at the last rung, then jumped off. He lost his balance and fell to the ground. Bullets kicked up the dirt near his face. He was a dead man. Jack rolled hard away and down the embankment, bullets marking the spot he just vacated. He reached the bottom and rose to his knees, pointing his pistol up where he knew his attackers would appear. A quick glance showed him the Wrangler was a good 300 feet away. If only he could get to it. The first guard appeared at the top of the embankment, an MP5 in his hands. He raised it to fire. His head exploded. An FBI sniper had found his mark. Chapter 69. Croatia. Parsons's new identity, complete with her new Montenegrin passport and biometric data to match, had gotten her all the way to Dubrovnik, where she boarded a private helicopter. She'd been a nervous wreck until she'd cleared Italian airspace and crossed the Adriatic. She monitored the news, but nothing was mentioned about tribulation. Neither a global financial crash nor a shooting war had occurred, nor seemed imminent. No matter. That was all Logan's affair. She had achieved her dream. Everything else was in the past. She'd covered her tracks and made her arrangements. Her spirits rose with the Eurocopter as it lifted into the sweet golden light of a glorious sunset. In less than half an hour, she'd arrive at her final destination, a small town of 20,000 on the crystal blue Adriatic coast, surrounded by Venetian walls and filled with Mediterranean charm. Peace, quiet, beauty, and no extradition treaty were just a few of the benefits she intended to enjoy in her early retirement. The only luggage she brought with her was a small, inexpensive carry-on, with just enough personal items and protein bars to make the 24-hour trek. She left her electronics and her worries behind. The handsome blue-eyed pilot had greeted her in the small but efficient office of the FBO where he operated. She was warmed in all the right places by his charming smile and runner's physique. But she knew this wasn't the time to break character. She did, however, accept his offer of a gin and tonic before boarding. Her favorite. Now some 500 feet above the white-capped water, she felt utterly safe. The adrenaline surge of the last 24 hours finally caught up with her. She felt herself suddenly tired, sitting in her seat, the rhythmic pulse of the beating rotors lulling her to sleep. It had been a long journey, but now she was free. She blinked heavily. The blue-eyed pilot was in the left seat navigating. He turned around and smiled at her again. "Tired?" he asked. "Terribly." "Just close your eyes. I'll wake you when we arrive." But she was already asleep. The blue-eyed pilot whispered a command in his headset to the other pilot, a woman. She nosed the EC-145 into a gentle dive, dropping altitude to just 50 feet off the deck. She stopped in midair, hovering. The blue-eyed pilot unbuckled himself and climbed back to the passenger compartment. He felt for a pulse. She was still alive, her breathing long and deep. She wouldn't wake for hours. In fact, she wouldn't wake at all. He reached behind her seat and pulled out a heavy duffel. He secured a 30-kilo dumbbell to her right wrist with a pair of handcuffs, unbuckled her seatbelt, opened the sliding door, and shoved her out. The dumbbell hit first, dragging Parsons by the right arm into the bright blue water, her body following like an arrow shot into the sea. He closed the door, climbed back into his seat, and buckled in for the short flight back home.
Days later. Chapter 70. Camp David, Maryland. Jack Jr. and his dad stood at the number one position on the skeet range, just beneath the high house. The range officer, Mike Cravey, a three-time NSSA national champion shooter, pointed at both men. Ready? Jack and his dad both nodded back. Ready. You won the toss, Ryan said. Jack took his stance and raised his shotgun, a Benelli Supersport Performance Shop semi-auto. He smashed the oversized red release button and the bolt slammed home with a satisfying thunk. Pull! The first bird flew out of the high house behind him. Jack fired, smashing the bird, just as the second bird darted from the low house. He shattered that one, too. Nice job, son. The first station's easy. No, I mean everything else. He looked his son in the eyes. Thanks to what you and Gavin did, we avoided a global economic apocalypse, recovered the $5 trillion, and stopped a potential holocaust. Jack shrugged. That was more Gavin than me. You're up. Ryan took his position, a case-hardened Cesar Guarini Summit Limited over and under in his hands. A real beauty. A recent anniversary gift from his wife. Another classic beauty. The president laughed. That train thing you did was pretty slick. Jack grinned. I always said it's better to be lucky than good. I think it was a little of both. Jack's decision to take out the warehouse refrigeration unit was based on Gavin's intel that the computer could only operate at mini-Kelvin temperatures. What Gavin didn't tell him was that those near-absolute zero temperatures were achieved through a process known as laser cooling, not Freon and a compressor, like an old Maytag making ice cubes. Destroying the warehouse HVAC unit had no effect whatsoever on the quantum computer's subatomic cooling. But tearing out that motor, the transformer, and the electrical lines along with it temporarily disrupted the power supply to the building. That disruption lasted less than 2 seconds before the emergency backup generator kicked on. That was just enough time to disrupt the laser cooling mechanism. Once disrupted, the tribulation system completely shut down and had to be rebooted. Jack's attack also distracted the warehouse security team long enough to give the FBI SWAT a window to insert and seize everything before Tribulation could resume operation. They grabbed the scientists, programmers, and hardware before the $5 trillion could be dispersed, and before the attack on Snowdragon, scheduled for launch just 7 minutes after the moment Jack disrupted the power. Ryan raised the shotgun to his eye, lining up the Bradley white front bead on top of the silver mid bead like a little snowman. Pull! Cravey hit his remote, and the orange clay disc shot out of the high house. The 12-gauge jerked on Ryan's shoulder. The bird exploded in a cloud of orange dust, just as the low house bird launched out of its thrower. Ryan fired. Missed. The clay crashed harmlessly into the grass behind them. Maybe it's time for shuffleboard, old-timer. Jack smiled. Ryan looked at Cravey. I'll take my extra here. Yes, sir. Ryan loaded a single shell into the top chamber and stepped up to the square. Pull! The low house bird sped into the sky. Ryan crushed it. He turned back to his son. Back to even, boyo, he said with a wink. Cravey grinned. He liked working with the Ryans. Good guys. Not like some of the congressional pricks the president sometimes brought out here. Jack and his dad marched over to the second station. Jack reloaded 2 more shells and stepped into the square. He punched the release button, racking his first round, then raised his Benelli to his eye. He put the front red optic and brass mid-beads together into their figure eight. Pull! The high house bird darted across the sky. Jack led it and pulled the trigger, busting the clay. The second bird flew past in the opposite direction. Jack nailed that one, too. You missed your calling, Ryan said. You should go pro with that thing. 2 stations does not a champion make, Jack said. He turned to Cravey. Right, Mike? Cravey grinned. Well, 2 in a row's a good start. You just gotta work your way up from there.
How far up? Jack asked.
Oh, I don't know.
Kraby scratched his chin thoughtfully. A couple 10,000 more ought to do it for starters.
I'll be lucky to hit the next one, Junior said, stepping out of the square, changing positions with his dad. The president barked, Pull!
Killed two clays.
Oh, so I guess now we're getting serious, Jack said.
I'm always serious.
I thought you knew that.
Jack laughed.
That move of Logan's, putting the near Kelvin Zero operation inside of a frozen food warehouse, makes me think he must have watched a lot of Breaking Bad.
He led the way to the third station. His dad followed. It was a damned smart play. The whole operation was. Logan knew to begin his drone attacks in the area where Sibbers had been knocked out. DOD's still looking into it, but they think his people might have been the ones to disable it.
Ryan sighed, frustrated.
The bastard really bamboozled us. Hell, who am I kidding? He got the better of me, is what it boils down to. White Mountain Logistics plus security was the perfect cover for his plan. He was in deep with the federal government, and his operations were global. He could move any kind of material to any location of his choosing without raising any suspicions, because he was a trusted and security-cleared defense contractor. And I bought into it, hook, line, and sinker. Can't blame yourself for that one, Pop. What he planned was so freaking crazy, no one could have predicted it.
Jack stepped into the square at the third station. He saw the set of his dad's jaw. He was taking this all really hard. Time to change the subject. I never did hear the rest of the story on Runzo. Gavin thought he was one of the good guys. Those birds aren't going to shoot themselves.
Fine.
Jack stepped up and loaded two more shells into his shotgun. Pull. Bang, bang. Two dead clays. Jack shrugged. So, what about Runzo?
The FBI went over those cartridges Gavin found with a fine-tooth comb. It led them to some other files stashed in other interesting places. The bottom line is that Runzo totally bought into what he called the heist of the universe. It was a real ego trip for him. But when he found out about Logan's war plan, he got cold feet. So not exactly a good guy. Not exactly. He helped let the horse out of the barn and tried to chase it down after the fact. If he hadn't shown up in Barcelona to meet with your friend Rene while you were there, Logan's plan might have actually worked.
The president stepped into the square, yelled pull, killed two clays.
Next station, gentlemen, Kraby said, pointing at number four. They headed over.
Whatever happened to the Parsons woman? Jack asked.
Interpol found a corpse that might be her washed up on shore in Montenegro. It's hard to tell from the level of decomp, so they're running DNA tests.
That's too bad. A real waste of genius.
Genius doesn't matter as much as character, Ryan said. Heraclitus said that character is destiny. But I think it's loyalty that's destiny. Logan loved himself more than his country and was willing to destroy it. Parsons loved her own ambition more than her science, and it got her killed. I'll take an honest man or woman over a smart one any day.
Jack took his position, loaded his weapon. Pull! Kraby let fly. Two puffs of red dust hung in the air.
Jack changed positions with his dad. The Caesar Guerini barked twice. Two birds shattered.
The Ryans followed Kraby over to the fifth station. They didn't speak. Jack's mind was clearly somewhere else.
What's bugging you, son?
Logan. Where the hell did he go?
Ryan darkened. We may never find the bastard.
I can't let it go until we do.
Well, don't let it ruin your game today, old man. You're up.
Jack stepped into the box. He pulled two more shells out of his pouch and loaded them.
The president laid a hand on his son's broad shoulder. I also wanted you to know that Renee Moore is getting her star at Langley. She died in service to her country, trying to bring Runzo in. There's a ceremony next week, if you'd like to attend.
Yeah, I would.
Ryan smiled and squeezed his neck. I'll join you, if you don't mind.
I read her service jacket. She was a real patriot, one of our best and brightest. He looked at his son. You two went to school together, didn't you? Jack looked at his dad and nodded slightly, unable to speak. He took a deep breath and gathered himself up. Ryan stepped back. Jack brought the gun to his eye. Pull! Two clays flew. Jack missed both. Chapter 71, Gulf of Mexico. The Dulces Sueños cruised due north some 11 miles north-northeast of Cancun at minimum speed to conserve fuel. It was scheduled to round the tip of the Yucatan Peninsula before sunrise. Despite its security contingent of cartel sicarios on board, the resin-infused carbon fiber vessel remained a very soft target. Logan knew that speed made a soft target hard, or at least harder to hit. He was as restless as the tide these days, trapped on board his Mexican-flagged luxury yacht. He was unable to risk going ashore even under the cartel's protection. America's eyes were everywhere. He still needed to hide. A luxury yacht near the Mayan coast was just another platinum needle in a haystack of platinum needles. Despite the late hour, he couldn't sleep. The rumble of the boat's big diesel engines calmed his nerves a little. The 280-foot, four-deck, cobalt-blue vessel remained far enough from shore to avoid any landward threats, and just inside the outer bounds of Mexico's territorial waters to remain under her jurisdiction. The Uxmal, a lightly armed twin-diesel Mexican Navy Tenochtitlan-class vessel, half the size of his own, patrolled these waters on a disciplined schedule like a vigilant sheepdog. Logan knew that Ryan wouldn't risk a shooting war with Mexico over something as trivial as his arrest, especially since the Tribulation Project had been completely defeated. The president was many things, but he wouldn't risk America's national interest to satisfy his personal need for vengeance. With Samler destroyed, Logan turned to his most important criminal ally, the infamous Gulf Cartel, under whose protection he now lived as he plotted a return to the stage. He'd stashed away enough money, resources, and weapons to secure his future, despite the fact Ryan's government was seizing White Mountain assets and shutting it down. The only thing that kept him from losing his mind was imagining the look on Ryan's face when he realized Buck Logan had played them all and nearly ran the table. All on Ryan's watch. The halo jump was timed to the patrol route of the Uxmal, now at its maximum distance from Logan's vessel. Speed and silence were key to the operation. So was the covering darkness of the moonless night. Adara was the first to splash into the dark water 2 miles due north of Dulces Sueños, a 55-pound float bag leading her way. Once in the water, she shed her chute, pulled on her fins, opened the bag, and began assembling the vehicle inside. 30 seconds later, the rest of the campus team dropped into the gulf, less than a quarter mile from Logan's luxury vessel. 3 landed due east, the other 2 due west of the big boat. Like Adara, they were kitted out in neoprene scuba suits. But strapped to each of their chests in specialized harnesses was a 77-pound Rotenor dive jet RD-2, along with suppressed H&K MP7A1 automatic PDWs, firing 4.6x30mm armor-piercing rounds. They also carried full underwater diving and boarding gear, along with a few other surprises. Once in the water and clear of their chutes, Clark, Ding, Dom, Midas, and Jack unharnessed their dive jets, pulled on the rest of their dive gear, and checked their comms. Waterproof Sonatus tactical mics attached like a retainer to their upper back molars, utilizing bone conduction through the jaw for both transmitting and receiving radio signals. The campus started using them after seeing them deployed by a Marine Fast platoon in Indonesia. Alpha ready? Clark asked. Alpha ready, Adara replied. Bravo and Charlie are ready. See you in 20. Clark gave the signal. Each of the men in Bravo and Charlie grabbed the control grips of the 4-foot-long lithium-ion dive sleds and slipped beneath the waves.
tracking on a swift and silent intercept course for their target. The Bravo and Charlie divers stopped on their first timed mark and stripped away their tanks, then rose just enough to breach the surface. At 100 yards, they were still far enough away that searching eyes would struggle to see the black forms in the black water. Each man swapped his scuba mask for NVGs and pulled his suppressed HK. "Bravo and Charlie are in position," Clark said. "Alpha, you are good to go."
"Launching now,"
Clark acknowledged. The clock was ticking. It wouldn't be long now. In less time than it took for Clark and the others to get into position, Adara had removed, unfolded, and assembled the waterproof UAV and its controller from the floatbag. She pulled on her own pair of waterproof NVGs and shoved the rolled-up bag between her thighs to add to her buoyancy. Time to rock and roll. Weighing just 55 pounds, the Songar UAV lifted swiftly into the air. The drone's night vision sensors, camera, and laser rangefinder fed its data in first-person shooter imagery into the gaming-styled handheld controller. The drone was hovering in position 100 feet above the water when Clark reported that both teams had reached their waypoints. Lying directly in the path of the oncoming vessel, Adara needn't fly the Songar any farther. The sound of the UAV's whirring blades was masked by the gentle rolling Gulf waters and the rumbling diesel engines coming toward her. She zoomed in on the brightly lit forward bridge on the third deck of the magnificent superyacht, bought and paid for with dirty narco money and crewed by narco killers. She felt no guilt when she set the reticle on the man standing at the helm and pressed the trigger. The helmsman never heard the shot or the sound of the breaking glass as the 5.56 NATO round tore into his abdomen. He fell to the floor with a scream, grabbing at his burning guts. The captain dashed out from behind a door just as more bullets, fired in 3-shot bursts, shattered more of the bridge-wide glass. 2 of the rounds struck him in the chest. A third ripped out his throat, splattering blood against the polished mahogany bulkhead as he dropped to the deck. The first shots startled the starboard guard out of his waking slumber on the second deck. He was no coward. The other Sicarios were shouting behind and below him as more shots rang out from the distance. He unslung his AK-47 Cuerno de Chivo, goat horn, and charged forward toward the sound of the gunfire coming from high and ahead of the boat. He raced at a dead run toward the bow and raised his rifle at the sparks flashing like angry fireflies in the night sky. But the sparks changed position, pointing at him. Bullets clawed his chest open. The brave Sicario died before he could even scream. Clark waited for the sound of AK-47 fire, the weapon of choice of assholes everywhere, before giving the go signal. All 5 men simultaneously revved their silent dive jet engines and sped toward the yacht. Their eyes were locked on the Sicarios charging forward on all 3 decks, firing their weapons at the Songar drone dancing in all directions off the bow and sniping at them from out of the dark. 30 seconds later, all 5 campus operators had reached the port and starboard sides of the slow-moving vessel, avoiding the spinning props at the stern. They slapped boarding hooks onto the rails, the first man up clearing the way for the others to follow. They scrambled aboard completely undetected by the distracted gunmen, leaving their dive jets behind. They'd already studied the yacht's schematics. Clark and the others knew where they had to go and what they had to do. Jack, most of all. As Clark and Bravo team cut down the Sicarios Adara hadn't already killed on the outer decks, Charlie team, Dom and Jack, began clearing the interiors. Jack in the lead. One fat, hairy gunman, naked save for his bikini underwear, leaped out of his stateroom with a gold-plated Desert Eagle, aiming it at Jack's face as he bolted past the door. A bullet from Dom's HK tore off the man's jaw before he could fire his pistol. He fell to the floor, mewling in agonizing pain. Dom did him a favor and put a second one on his skull. Jack raced up the 3 flights of interior stairs, reaching the 4th deck, where Logan's private quarters were located. Logan reached for a mag to slam home into his daddy's ivory-handled .45 Colt just as Jack turned the corner into the door, his PDW held high ready. Jack charged forward and knocked the pistol out of Logan's meaty hand with the butt of his HK. The Colt crashed to the floor with a thunk of heavy metal. Jack pulled his weapon back to his eye. Jack heard the calm, professional chatter of his team echoing in his skull, and the sharp retorts of the last 4.6x30mm rounds dispatching the remaining Sicarios. Logan looked at Jack like a wounded child, slapped around by an angry parent.
"I wasn't going to use that on you, boy."
He glanced at the pistol on the floor.
"It was for me."
"No shit." Jack's finger slipped onto the HK's 2.5-pound trigger. It would take more energy to scratch his nose than to kill this son of a bitch where he sat. But his dad's orders were clear. Alive, not dead. "No easy way out for you, Logan. Instead, you're going to spend the next 40 years of your miserable life in a cement hole somewhere, tied into your chair and crapping in a baggie in the dark." Logan squared up in his chair, puffing out his chest, defiance burning in his eyes.
"I don't care what you do to me. It won't change the fact I kicked the president's ass. My name will still go down in history.
As an asterisk at best.
I did what was right."
"Are you kidding? How does setting the world on fire constitute right in any sane universe?" Logan sat up straighter.
"Sane? Sane? $244 trillion of global debt is sane? The whole financial system needs one giant flush. A year of jubilee for the whole world to start everything all over again. That's what I was gonna do."
"And the $5 trillion you stole was just a finder's fee, right?
A man's gotta get paid, doesn't he?"
"Forget your Freakonomics. A world war isn't a fresh start for anybody." Logan leaned forward, his face reddening.
"I make no apologies for trying to defend my country. Extreme threat demands extreme action. I'm a loyal American patriot. It was my duty to try and destroy America's enemies before they destroyed us. In less than a decade, the Chinese and the Russians will have the means to wipe us out. They already have the will to do it."
"You just forgot one thing. The Chinese and Russians might have blown themselves to bits in the Bering Sea, but they would have figured out pretty damn quick that someone else was behind it, and they would have blamed us."
"That's why I did it. I put the ball in the red zone. First and goal. All Ryan had to do was punch it into the end zone and win the game once and for all. I knew he didn't have the balls for a first strike. So I was gonna do it for him because I sure as hell do."
"The only problem, Logan, is that you aren't the president and never will be." Logan chuckled with disgust.
"Don't I know it?"
He sat back. "It was my destiny to be president. I was born and bred for it." Logan's big hands rubbed the armrests of his hated wheelchair.
"But the hell of it is, sometimes fate makes the wrong man king."
Clark gave the order to stack the dead bodies into the yacht's first floor deck compartment away from prying eyes until they got deeper out into the gulf, where they'd toss them overboard, chum for the hungry sharks patrolling the deeper waters. Clark, a former chief bosun's mate, knew how to handle a boat, even one as big as the Dulce Sueños. He maneuvered it closer to Adara, still in the water, the Songar already packed for the trip home. Dom helped her on board as Ding made the call to the CV-220B Osprey, a SOCOM tilt-rotor bird winging its way toward them from its base at MacDill AFB, Florida. The others pulled the dive jets from the water and secured them, then prepped the yacht for the journey across the Gulf to Houston. Jack arrived on the aft deck with a handcuffed Logan slumped in his chair just as the tilt-rotor Osprey arrived overhead. Its twin turboshaft Rolls-Royce engines rotated to 90 degrees to vertical, converting the airplane into a helicopter in just 12 seconds. The pilot's voice echoed clearly in Jack's skull, The Sonatus mics eliminated the ambient noise of the roaring turbines and beating rotor blades. Jack confirmed. The clock was ticking the moment the Osprey entered Mexican airspace, something a hostile Mexican government wouldn't look kindly upon. Interceptors would be launched within minutes if the Osprey didn't clear back out pronto. Clark reported the yacht's onboard radar showed the Uxmal making a turn and heading back their way at flank speed. We need to get this tub moving fast. A rope was lowered from the hell hole in the belly of the Osprey. A dual Y-strap was attached to the rope with carabiners on each arm of the Y. Jack snapped the carabiners to the D-rings on the shoulder straps of Logan's Stabo extraction harness. He's on the string, Jack said. Roger that, the pilot said. A winch inside the Osprey turned. Logan lifted out of his chair helplessly, his dead legs dangling, his cuffed hands immobilized. He cleared the deck 5 feet, then 10. The big, crippled body began slowly spinning in the prop wash. If you like fishing with live bait, he's all yours, Jack said. The pilot had been briefed on his cargo's criminal actions. Too bad I forgot to bring my fishing license. The pilot laughed as he signed off. The Osprey's big engines roared again as it leaped into the sky, Logan still dangling from the rope. No time to wait and pull him into the Osprey. The accelerated speed and rotor wash spun him like a top as he rocketed into the moonless air. The pilot swung away at a steep angle, pointing his machine toward home. Jack's eyes tracked Logan into the dark that finally swallowed him up. Logan was still alive. Mission accomplished. A wide grin creased Jack's face. He could still hear Logan's screams. Epilogue. Washington, D.C., the White House residence. Jack came in the private entrance, his face shielded by an umbrella and the two PPD agents that accompanied him. There wasn't any press standing around in the rain, and if there had been, the PPD would have shooed them away. To maintain his cover, Jack never appeared in current family photos or at public events with his parents, but he loved hanging out with his folks. It was too much trouble for them to come to his place, so he came to them whenever he could, especially when his mother offered to make her famous burgundy beef stew and apple pie for dinner, his favorites. His three siblings were all out of town. He wished they could be there, too. Jack came into the kitchen and hugged his mom, holding her for a little longer than usual. Are you feeling all right, son? She touched his bearded face with her palm. The gesture was equal parts motherly and medical. I hope you're not coming down with anything. Nah, I'm fine. Just tired. Smells good in here. Let's eat. Jack helped his mom set the table and serve the food. Senior said grace. The three of them dug in. Kathy worried about her son. Renee Moore's star ceremony had been that morning. Her husband told her earlier that Jack took it harder than he expected. They must have been closer than I thought, Ryan said. Kathy wanted to take her son's mind off the memorial. So I never did hear about your trip to Spain, she said. Tell me about it. Jack perked up a little bit. Amazing country. Wonderful history. Fabulous food. I can't wait to go back. Maybe someday we can all go there together as a family. I mean, later, of course. Sounds like a plan, Ryan said. I always wanted to see a bullfight. You meet anybody interesting? Kathy asked. Jack's faint smile vanished. He took a long, slow breath, thinking of Brosa. Yeah, I did. Anyone you'd like us to meet? She asked hopefully. She was antsy for grandkids. Honey, Ryan said, frowning. Probably won't happen. Jack's voice fell away. He set his spoon down, lost in thought. It had been a rough day. I'm sorry, Jack. I shouldn't have asked. Jack shrugged. No, it's fine. He took a sip of water, then sat up straighter, gathering himself. The shadow on his face passed away. So good, he said with a smile to his mother as he picked up his spoon.
He shoveled the heaping bite into his mouth and chewed a chunk of succulent beef with gusto. Kathy studied Jack's face. Senior hadn't told her what her son had been up to recently, only that he was one hell of a kid. But the pride in her husband's cracking voice when he said it spoke volumes. Jack must have risked everything to accomplish something that really mattered. Just like her husband had, so many times in the past. She'd seen the expression on Jack's face before. It was the same one her husband wore after he'd come home from long trips he couldn't talk about with her. She knew in her heart that behind the hard, confident mask they both wore in public lay an inexpressible grief for things and people lost. She ached for her son's sorrow. But her heart skipped a beat as she glanced first at her husband and then her boy. Pride washed over her. The two of them were so alike. Jack was truly his father's son.
This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tom Clancy, Firing Point, by Mike Madden. This program was directed by Chris Kaczewski. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2020 by the estate of Thomas L. Clancy, Jr., Rubicon Incorporated, Jack Ryan Enterprises Limited, and Jack Ryan Limited Partnership. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.